Welcome to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. I'm Logan Quigley, and today we're going to be diving into an area of medieval history that's often overlooked. These are the roles of the ministeriales, the people who were responsible for putting the policies of nobility into action. To help us understand who the ministeriales were and why they mattered, I'm joined today by Aaron Patti, an interdisciplinary scholar interested in the intersections between art and architectural history, primarily medieval and Baroque, with digital humanities methodologies. Since earning his PhD in European art history and in applied informatics from Heidelberg University in 2021, Aaron has worked as a postdoc at the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, Germany, and he has served as co-editor of the journal Bergen und Schlosser. So thanks for joining me, Aaron.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To start, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My background is in medieval studies, though my focus has been primarily upon archaeology and construction research of castles and churches and palaces, so kind of the built heritage of the Middle Ages. I originally got interested because my mother is from Germany, and so I spent many summers with my grandparents over there visiting various castles around the house, and they were nearby at least. And one of them actually ended up being the castle that I ended up studying for my master's, and I built my entire PhD around. So it's something that's been with me for a long time.
Would you give us a quick preview of what the ministeriales were, why you might think it's important that we know this information?
Yeah, so the ministeriales were basically a status of people that lived in the Holy Roman Empire. They did not exist in other kingdoms, so in France or in England or other areas. They were essentially the administrators of the state. And so where you had roughly 5% of the society were nobles, another 30% were roughly ministeriales. So it's a pretty significant chunk of the population during the medieval period of the Holy Roman Empire. And they were in charge of managing the royal estates and even some of the private estates of the different royal families. They even managed the estates of the bishoprics and down to even counts and monasteries. So there were different levels of them. And they were responsible for basically the entire politics of the empire at a more local level. They also were main advisors to the kings and to the emperors. So it was a group of people who could rise in status based upon merit more than their birth.
Can you help us understand why this is information we should care about when we look back at the Middle Ages, especially the Holy Roman Empire?
Definitely, because the Holy Roman Empire was very different than the other kingdoms that were contemporaneous. So you have very different social structures throughout England and France and the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire distributed its power or the ability to manage or to administer politics across a wider range of people. So the ministeriales were this group of people who were in charge of things that in other countries only nobles would have been. And so when we look back in the Middle Ages and we think it's a period where there's this very small exclusive groups of nobles ruling everything, well, that wasn't the case in the Holy Roman Empire. And so it really kind of helps us reset how we look at the Middle Ages, particularly in its biggest state. The Holy Roman Empire was substantially bigger than any other kingdom at the time. The only one that probably come close was the Byzantine Empire. So it's a very significant state with a very different social structure that is worth really looking into, give us a new perspective on what the society looked like.
You mentioned that ministeriales were really only a facet of the Holy Roman Empire and not of the surrounding kingdoms. Could you help us get an understanding of what the Holy Roman Empire was like during this period, also situating it within the context of the other kingdoms and political entities that existed at the time?
So essentially, the Holy Roman Empire was the state that succeeded East Francia.
East Francia, that's Charlemagne, right? After he died, didn't they split up the Carolingian Empire?
Yeah, so after the Treaty of Verdun in 843, Charlemagne's grandsons split the empire amongst themselves. The eastern part became East Francia, western became West Francia, later on France, and the middle Francia was just basically dominated by the other two. Over time, East Francia developed into a newer identity, one which we now would say would be like the German kingdom. At that time, they still considered themselves East Franks. So the Holy Roman Empire succeeded East Francia in 962 with the election of Otto I as emperor. It was a state that, by the beginning of the 13th century, extended all the way down to southern Italy. So from Denmark to Italy, and from modern-day Poland, so modern-day city of Gdansk, all the way down to the city of Arles in France. Basically, all of eastern France was a part of this. It was a major state that controlled many different kingdoms. So there are, at any point, at least 3 to 5 different kingdoms within this, many other duchies. And the Holy Roman Empire existed for quite a while. It was eventually dissolved under Napoleon. But during the High Middle Ages, so from the year 1000 until 1300, the Holy Roman Empire was a very significant player within European politics. And this is actually the area where the ministeriales were the most active. So the period from about the year 1000 to the year 1300 was really kind of their playground, so to speak, where these different families rose up from serving the different families of the nobles to becoming nobles themselves.
Can you help me understand how the church fit into all of this when we talk about the Holy Roman Empire? What is the connection there?
Otto, the king of East Francia, marched on to Rome to be crowned emperor in the same style that Charlemagne had done. The role of the church within the empire was instrumental, actually. At first, the emperors actually wanted to control who would be ordained bishop, who would be consecrated, who would be invested. And they would actually put in their own cousins and different sort of things. This was a policy called the Reichskirche, so the imperial church, where they basically tried to run the entire church structure within the empire. This all came to a head in 1122 with the Concordat of Worms, where the Vatican put an end to this sort of thing. Anselm of Canterbury was the one who famously brought it to England in the early 12th century. And so it was something that was a ripple effect that began in the empire and then spread throughout the rest of Europe, where the church became a bit more powerful. And it's precisely with that backdrop that the emperors, trying to wrest that power back from the church, started employing ministerialen, or these ministeriales, in more capacities, in wider capacities.
So the ministeriales were kind of a way to exert more secular power over society.
In many ways. So especially by the time of the reign of Emperor Henry VI in the late 12th century, so the 1190s, his ministeriales were so powerful and so uncontested that by the time he died, the Pope even waged a crusade against the ministeriales specifically.
Wow.
And so to run them out of Italy, they had become too powerful. And so they eventually kind of ebbed away from that role as the 13th century progressed. Eventually, the King Rudolf von Habsburg, when he was elected in 1273, just basically got rid of all of them. He was someone who had risen from the status of count all the way to king in one lifetime, which is, I think, the only one who ever managed. And his arch nemesis were the ministerialen, because they were the ones taking all the positions away from the counts. And so he had a kind of an axe to grind when he took power and rid himself of this nuisance. But the ministeriales were a group who were also involved in the church. So one of the families I specifically looked at, one of their members even became a bishop. So they were very involved in the monastic system, both as nuns, as monks. They had different family strategies that they would employ that made them integral parts of both the state and of the church.
You've already touched on how the role of the ministerialis would have potentially changed over the centuries. You mentioned that they became quite a bit more powerful, such that by 1190, they had risen to enormous heights. Were there sort of large-scale, trackable, systemic changes? Was it really kind of case by case? How did this happen?
The first ministerialis that we know of ruled in the later part of Charlemagne's reign, so before he died in 814, and then all the way through the 9th century. These ministeriales were nobles, though, and so they took the term ministeriales as ministers of the court. By the time East Francia broke away and Otto became emperor, these positions were no longer given to nobles. Instead, they were given to his servants. And this was a way of making them more loyal to him, because Otto had a notorious period of having to fend off half-brothers and other dukes who opposed him. So he really wanted people who were close to home, literally. They were people from the familia, which is the servitude of his household. And so these servientes, as they were called, were serving the emperors, but they had actually at the beginning not very many rights. They were given these high positions, but they could have them taken at any time. So they didn't really have much say in what happened. Things changed, though, very soon thereafter. So there are three actually laws that were passed within about 50 years of one another. The first was in 1025 in the city of Worms on the Rhine. The second one was in Bamberg in 1057. The third one was in 1070 in the Palace of Weissenburg, which is modern-day France. All three provided outlined rights of what the ministeriales were allowed to do and how they're able to work within society. So even the first one was authored by Bishop Burchard of Worms, who was a huge mover and shaker of his period. He rebuilt the Cathedral of Worms. He also wrote the Liber Decretorum, which was a system of laws regarding how the rights of the clergy and laymen are to be played out, as well as social norms. The rights of the ministeriales themselves were then expanded upon in 1057 by the bishop at Bamberg, where he included the role of forester. So the traditional roles of these ministeriales were chamberlain, cupbearer, steward, and marshal, which corroborate precisely the roles of the prince electors later on. But these rights were then extended even just a couple years later in 1070 to include the right that a ministeriale who was no longer commissioned could seek employment at another court. So he was able to go on the job market essentially and just leave the king if he wanted. And if the king had no more duties for him, he didn't have to wait around. He could go work at another court, at a bishop's court or somewhere else. But on top of that, these ministeriales were given roles within the imperial territories as escorts. They're even made sheriffs, which is a bit different than the sheriff in England. This is more limited. But nevertheless, they were in charge of what were called the fiscus. So the royal fiscus was the imperial territory, and they were given charge of that. So through these rights, they were given more and more privileges as to what they were allowed to do and not to do, less of what they were not to do, actually. And increasingly over time, they became a major player in politics. And so there are many different stories how this played out. But essentially, as the dynasty shifted from the Salian to the Hohenstaufer or the Staufer dynasty, the ministeriales became a larger component of that politic and started employing them in more positions because they were more loyal than the nobles were. And eventually, it got to the point where you had ministeriales like a man named Markwart von Annweiler, who was from a servant's house in Germany, but later became, he had two duchies and two counties in Italy. He was this larger-than-life character. He was the commander of the imperial fleet, just unbelievable titles that this guy took, but at home was nothing more than the son of a servant. So it was very, very strange time.
A real rags-to-riches story.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things you had mentioned earlier is the way that ministeriales often served in the church as well. Could you talk about the differences between ministeriales who would have been working in ecclesiastical sector versus those who would have been working to do more secular administration?
So typically, the more clever families, let's say, of these ministeriales would have many of their sons and daughters employed in different capacities. So within the ecclesiastical structure as well as within the secular structure. If you take, for example, the family von Lautern Hoheneck, which is the family that I've done most of my research on, they at one point had one son who was the sheriff of one of the imperial territories, another son who is a legal scholar, another one who is a bishop. So they kind of spread them out. They had different roles, but one thing that is notable is that the ministeriales who took either secular or ecclesiastical positions were normally very loyal to the dynasty of the king who put them in that position in the first place. And so these were loyalties that spread over generations. So the role of the ministeriales within the church was not really well regarded by many of the nobles at the time. They consider them kind of burners, if you will. So if there was a period of unrest and there was an election and the canonici had to get together to elect who would become the new bishop, in this sort of tumultuous periods, they were very unlikely to elect a noble whose reputation could be stained by, you know, the tumult of the time. Instead, they would elect a ministeriales. And who would take the blame, basically.
The fall guy, okay.
Exactly. And one of these characters was this guy, Landolt von Hoheneck, who became bishop of Worms. Very bad at his job. He ended up just being a military entourage member of Emperor Frederick II. He actually spent most of his time in the entourage of the campaigns in Italy. He almost spent no time in Worms at all during the entirety of his tenure. But this wasn't just him. During the campaigns of Frederick I and his son Henry VI and grandson Frederick II, 37% of the princes within the war campaigns were actually bishops or abbots. And so there was kind of this backlash to the investiture crisis that was supposed to have been concluded in 1122. So it was kind of this backlash where they wanted to be more involved in the secular politics.
From what it sounds like, ministeriales were more of a profession than a distinct social class. If you were able to have people from non-noble sectors of society move into this role, and then potentially even over generations move into the nobility. Is that accurate? Do you speak of it as a social class more so, or more of a profession?
It's kind of a merge of both, actually, because it begins as a profession. So certainly during the 11th century, there are some families who have different members who are elevated to the status of chamberlain or cupbearer or marshal by a certain king or emperor. And they're recorded in the charters, only they're only given one name. They're only given their first name. So sometimes they have very strange names like Puzzili or some different names like this. They don't have family names. And this is a big problem with ministeriales, because when you want to look at a noble who takes a position, like a administrator position, he keeps his name whether he's in that position or not. So if it's the Count of Spanheim, who's now a marshal of the empire in Frankfurt, he doesn't change his name. A ministeriale changes his name wherever he goes.
Oh.
And this makes it very confusing sometimes. So if you have, sometimes you can have a guy named Eckbert von Worms, who's the son of a ministeriale in Worms. He then is commissioned as a ministeriale in Alzey. Now he's Eckbert von Alzey. And then he's commissioned to the royal palace in Lautern. Now he's Eckbert von Lautern. And so he keeps changing his name wherever he goes, because there's this link between status and your heritage. So your heritage is dependent upon that status. So your acknowledgement as someone within the rest of the court is they would see them as ministeriales, but they would see them as fulfilling a necessary role. So they weren't entirely looked down upon, but they were not considered equivalent to nobles at all.
You don't have to deal with all the baggage of the nobility, but you kind of get all the perks.
Yeah, but the perks only lasted for a lifetime, though. And that was always the difficult part for some of these families, because there are different formula for determining how someone is a noble. But essentially, two big components were, can you pass your name to your next generation? And can you inherit an estate? Many of them couldn't. And so if we take this example of Markwart von Annweiler that I gave before, two times dukes, two times count of Italy, sea commander, all these other titles, he was actually the main person who was attacked during this crusade after the death of his emperor. He lost every title and his son just disappeared into oblivion, and there was no estate left to the son. So it was one of these magnificent downfalls that you see within these histories, where there's other families that managed to train their sons to take on that role of the administrator position as sheriff for many generations, to the point where it was just expected that they would get these inheritances. However, the inheritances were loans from the emperor. And so they would get castles loaned to them or different territories loaned to them that they were in charge of. And these territories could be taken away at any point. And so you could have these families that would pass them down, so to speak, over many generations. But then the instant a king came along and noticed, okay, these are ministeriales who are pretending like they're nobles, I'll take their lands away, which is what Rudolf von Habsburg did.
It's a good reminder to us all to always beware of a loan.
Yes.
In the wider Middle Ages, were ministeriales the greatest example of social mobility?
I'm convinced personally, at least from what I've seen, but they were people who didn't really have any counterparts that I'm aware of. They also served as envoys. And so there's a case of many of them being imperial envoys to other states. And so they're being sent to meet with dignitaries and other kings even, or even when it came to the capture of Richard Lionheart, when he was captured in 1193, he was imprisoned in Germany for a while, and his ransom was 100,000 silver marks. And these were delivered by the ministeriales, who apparently were together with Eleanor of Aquitaine to deliver the funds. So they had this direct connection to these other people. They were even within the German Minnesang. So these are stories, basically minstrel songs that were written by nobles, including emperors or even ministerialen. So there's Ulrich von Lichtenstein, who's a famous one. There's a few other ones who, through their deeds, were able to attain noble status. And so that was not always expected. It was not always possible, but a few of them managed, where through one lifetime, within one lifetime, they went from ministeriale to count. And this was a feat that within the German context was something that people really looked up to. It's called what's called the Tugendadel. So an adel is a noble, Tugend is a virtue, so a virtuous noble. So the one who by his own merit is able to attain noble status. And so you think of characters like William Longsword or some other ones from other areas. So there are some examples of from other countries where you have these characters who go from basically nothing to nobility within a lifetime, but they don't have that pathway of the ministeriale that existed within the Holy Roman Empire. So you had far more within the Holy Roman Empire being able to move up into the nobility than in other states.
I can't help but wonder who got access to this fairly fabulous opportunity. Were there certain groups of people who were excluded from these roles? The first thing that comes to mind, could a woman become a ministeriale?
It's a very interesting question because women did not, as far as I've seen, have any specific ministerialis roles, so administrator positions anywhere. However, they're very clearly involved. And so if you look at the 13th century specifically, because the charter seemed to be more detailed in the 13th century when it comes to ministeriale families, it's clear that the husbands or the brothers or fathers, whoever they are out doing their task as sheriff or escort leader within the territory, or even as imperial chamberlain, whatever their duty is. And the wives are actually running their own feudal territories. And so their own loans are being run by the wives. And you see this within the charters where the men will show up for a charter to be signed and be ratified, and the wives will be in there with them. So the wives will be in the witness list. They'll be, for example, they'll be wording like, after discussing with my wife, Margarete, we decided to do thus. And so they're very much involved. And from what I can tell, they're very much the people who are actually running the finances within their own estates. So within their own loaned territories, the women are the ones in charge there. So they're definitely playing a major role. Now, who can actually become a ministeriale in the first place? This is a question that nobody really knows as far as the current scholarship is concerned. What is known is that there are generally three levels of them, starting from lowest to highest. The lowest level would be the ones serving counts in monasteries. The next level would be those serving bishops or royal courts. So if you think about these rights that were granted from Bamberg, that's a bishop, or Weissenburg, that's a royal court. And the highest level, the third level, was the imperial court. And so you had ministerialen who were serving at the imperial court who would actually look down at the ones who were serving at a monastic court, as an example. There was this stratified structure even amongst themselves. So it wasn't like this one big group that everyone's helping each other out. They're kind of clawing to get to that top level. And if you're at the bottom level, the count at monastery, if you were released from your administrative position, well, you weren't considered a ministeriale anymore. And that was it. You just became a servant and no chances, basically, socially. And so what you see is that this is a more difficult group to study because oftentimes they don't even make it into the big charters. So if you look at the Registra Imperii, which is the 130 some thousand charters of the empire, the lower level ministeriale are not in there at all. They're not mentioned at all. And so the only way to find them is through the registers and charters of local abbeys or other monasteries or local counties, which is difficult because none of these things are digitized. So you really have to read them and find them. And so basically, if you don't know that they're there, they don't exist, it seems like. But they're there. They're actually the biggest group. So this third level, this lower level, is the biggest group of ministeriales by far. And what you find is that they make attempts to marry in higher into the group just above them. So the families of ministeriales serving the bishoprics or the imperial courts. But in essence, all these groups are taken from the servants of a king's household or a bishop's household or whoever it may be. That's how they have to get the position in the first place. So it's really kind of a, you're in the right time at the right place sort of thing.
And then when you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you get it all taken away.
Exactly. Yeah. Or if you suddenly lose favor, it's over. And so there's many, many different examples of that. So the majority of the ministeriale families that existed, the vast majority of them ended up not becoming nobles.
You started to tap on the door of this, and where I'd like to go next is to think about your scholarship. I'm curious, are there any scholars, any researchers that were really helpful for forming your thought on this? Also, you mentioned the difficulty of having to study the subject largely using documents that aren't digitized, that exist probably in not only an array of languages, but dialects within those languages. How was that for you?
This was one of the more difficult things because there are a series of authors who have written on the Ministeriales. Probably the first one was a dissertation published in 1950 by a guy named Karl Bosel. He is a contentious character within German history because he was a Nazi member who put a lot of that into his writing, a lot of his ideology into his writing about the Ministeriales. Originally, he was supposed to publish in like 1944. The war got in the way and he had to publish in 1950. By that time, he had to take all those ideological pieces out, or as many as he could. But when you read it closely, you see remnants of that very clearly, which basically led to no one reading or writing about the Ministeriales for 40 years. And so it wasn't until the 1990s, late 1980s, that it came back into fashion to kind of, you know, let's take another look at this. Kind of the post-fall of the wall scenario where it's like, let's take another look at our history. Werner Heschberger and Jan Koip are two German scholars who have written extensively about the Ministeriales. And they were certainly the two most influential for me when I was trying to get an overview of who these people really were. Beyond that, actually going into the charters, the first place I started was with this Regis Imperii, these thousands of medieval charters where emperors and kings and everyone's mentioned, everyone of note, let's say, and basically looking down at the witness list. So who's here hanging out in the witness list? Sometimes there's 100, sometimes there's 3. Those have been digitized, fortunately. But basically taking that as the main lead to go to other places. So this led to looking at annals and registers from the archbishops of Mainz and the bishops of Worms, looking at the counts of Spanheim, the counts of Felden, so in this area. So these local counts and local abbeys and stuff. But as you mentioned, they're written in different languages. So not all of them have been translated into German. Many of them are still in Latin, in a medieval Latin. Luckily, most of them are registers. So they're charters that were transcribed sometime in the last 150 years. But other than that, not much has been done with them. But sometimes they transcribe them directly from the dialect. So you have really fun dialectal texts. Fortunately, I speak the dialect of that area, so I was able to read these things, which was surprising because the dialect hasn't changed a whole lot even within 600 years at some time. But you have funny, you know, spelling things, like instead of the word auf, meaning up or upon, they would say uff, and sometimes it'd be spelled UF or UFF or UFFF, different spelling. So it's kind of fun.
It's very internet speak today. I've definitely written oof myself a couple of times.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious about what the logistics of that kind of study were. Did your research necessarily involve a lot of travel because a lot of these resources weren't digitized?
Well, I was in the University of Heidelberg at the time. So I was very close to the sources of where I need to look. Also, the university library had most of these registers available, but it did require some travel into the former areas where these people were, which was kind of part and parcel of my project because the original project was to do the construction research of 4 castles. And by way of researching these castles, I discovered these families and then they became the new interest. But I had to go to archives in different places, like the main archive in the city of Speyer for that region. Many of the things had been digitized. So at least the imperial charters had been digitized. That was very fortunate. So if you are interested in this topic, you can get involved by already conducting research digitally. So the Academy of Sciences and Literature in Mainz has an entire website where they have all the 130,000 charters digitized and freely available.
Incredible.
And so you can read these. They're in German, but nowadays in the AI world, it's very easy to translate that. There are a variety of other sources that are also available digitally. But again, if you want to get into one region really thoroughly, you have to really get into the undigitized documentation. So the more obscure registers and annals, because that's where you find a lot of the meat, so to speak, of what you're looking for. That would require you to learn German or to be able to read it. There are a variety of different tools that you can use. For example, if you find a book and you scan the page, you can use OCR and then have that translated. So there's different methods for doing that. But it would require some sort of travel if you're not already in Germany. However, I have looked, since I'm now in the States, and there are a variety of universities in the States who have access to these registers. They have them in their libraries. And so through interlibrary loan, it would probably be possible to get these texts as well. And again, I'm only speaking of a small region. So my research has been on the German Palatinate, a very specific part of it. But these existed throughout the entire Kingdom of Germany, which means that there are literally hundreds of other sources out there.
Were there any other forms of technology that really abetted your research or that were instrumental in helping you track and manage this information?
this was a problem that I encountered very early on when I started reading through these charters was, okay, how do I catalog this? How do I map out what they're doing? So their economic proceedings, their political proceedings, their statuses, because they're constantly changing status when they move, or if they don't even move, they just get a new status or they rotate. And so how do you model all this? And so I ended up reaching out to a scholar at the Academy of Sciences in Mainz, who is an expert in graph databases, who really helped me develop my own graph database to model all this information. And so I ended up being kind of the mechanism not only to organize all my data, but also to recall it. So when you have all these different characters running around, all the different things they're doing, it's very difficult just to keep it in mind or just look through your notes. Since it was a graph database, it works through a script. It's called, in this case, called Cypher, where rather than putting everything in Excel tables the whole time, you can use this script that combines different data points to one another. So it makes it a lot more flexible, a lot more manageable. It also had a good visualization component. So the database I was using was called Neo4j, the software I was using. And this allowed me to kind of look at the networks in a visual manner to see, who's connected to these different points or these different charters, or what are they doing? Where are they trading? And this allowed me to run queries actually across 1,500 people coming sourced from 700 charters, in which I found 400 different events going on where they're trading mills or logging rights or any sort of thing. And from that, I could start doing analyses like patterns, what sort of patterns are happening, or what's being traded when the king isn't in the territory? What are his ministeriales doing when there isn't a king at all? How are they handling it? Are they being loyal to the throne or are they doing their own thing? And so through this graph database, I was able to find a lot of these answers to see, okay, what is their attitude towards their position of power?
It also sounds like it's just a lot better doing that than, like you said, having to deal with plugging everything into a little Excel spreadsheet.
Definitely, definitely. And especially when I look back at some of the researchers from the 90s and 80s, the amount of work that they're able to do and keep in their minds is phenomenal because they didn't use a graph database for this. They had other systems, of course, remembering these things, but I'm certain that if they had this access, they would have had a much larger spread of data that they would have been able to work through. And that's the exciting part, is that these data are also freely available. So when I published my PhD, everything was published through the Heidelberg University Publishing, and it's all freely available through the library there. So if anyone's interested in finding more out about the castles they lived in, the different building phases, or even the entire spreadsheets of all these different names and people over time, they're all freely available there.
That's a really good opportunity for us to transition into thinking about anything that you'd like to direct our listeners towards. This might be research that you found useful while you were working. This could be projects that you're excited about that are kind of unfolding now in the world. And this might also be, and I would hope that this would include, the title of your dissertation so people can go and find it.
Yeah, certainly. So I'll begin with the dissertation. It's called CITADEL. So it's an acronym. It stands for Computational Investigation of the Topographical and Architectural Designs in an Evolving Landscape. So kind of a bit of a mouthful, but kind of the glue of the project was this graph database that linked architectural analyses using high resolution 3D models, the social network analyses of the ministeriales and the nobles, as well as geographical analyses using GIS, all into one database where I could run queries that would draw from all the different data sets. So all those data sets, everything is about 500 gigabytes of data. All that stuff is available through HeiData. So HeiData. And if you put in CITADEL, it should be pretty easy to find. And the whole data set is there. So that would be one place to look if anyone's interested in ministeriales or this period of history. There are a number of different projects going on through Heidelberg. A revision of the Registre Imperii is ongoing, where they're looking at all these different charters. And really the emphasis right now is finding the people who aren't really on the forefront. So looking through these witness lists of what people used to overlook. So all the people in there who are the lower level ministeriales or maybe just servants, people have stories that would be really interesting to find out about that might give us a deeper perspective on what society actually looked like back then. That would be a good place to look. The sources, I've mentioned the website, registreimperii.de, I think is actually the site. And there's a few other ones. There's monasterium.de. There's a variety of different websites that have information on where you get access to the actual charter. So it's not just transcriptions, but sometimes the actual image of the charter, that if you have a paleography skills, then you can read it yourself, which is sometimes very difficult. But there's a variety of different sources. I have an article that was recently published just this last year in a volume called Digitizing Heritage. It was a collaboration done at Heidelberg University, focusing on digitizing various forms of heritage. In this case, my article has to do with how to set up a graph database for organizing and analyzing digital heritage. And so it's kind of a play-by-play of if you find yourself in a similar position where you have a lot of different data about people and events and proceedings and locations and over time, this would be a viable option for you, how to organize your data. I explained how I organized my own dissertation. My dissertation even includes more in-depth of how I did that. And so if you're interested in knowing specifically how I was able to build this graph database, my dissertation has an entire chapter devoted to that. It's also freely available, so it can be downloaded anytime. Also, I regularly write on the topic of the Ministeriales on my Substack called Maintaining the Realm. It's a Substack dedicated towards dispelling the myths of the Middle Ages within the Holy Roman Empire specifically. And so I don't go too much into France or England. I do focus on the Holy Roman Empire specifically during the High Middle Ages, where I go through where does the Holy Roman Empire come from in detail, what was the legal status of people in the empire. So it really focuses on social and legal histories of people who lived during that time. That's something that I would certainly recommend if people are interested.
I'm wondering if you might be able to give us a little bit of a combo deal here, both a reflection on why we ought to pay attention to the Ministeriales, how understanding them can nuance and shape our perspective on the Middle Ages, but also if there was any individual that you felt like throughout your research that you really connected to, was there someone's story who stood out to you?
Certainly. I would start with the first part of your question. I think researching the Ministeriales is necessary, because most of our knowledge of the social structure from the Middle Ages comes either from the charters of the kings and the nobles or from archaeology. And so you have the material record, what's been excavated, how people lived, what they ate, where they lived, what they wore, these sort of things. And then you have the activities, the economic proceedings and political proceedings of the nobles. But what about everyone in between? And what about all these other people who lived daily lives and did all sorts of different work that weren't worthy enough to be in the big charters, but also whose stories cannot be uncovered by just excavations? And so these stories are all there. Not all of them, but there's a lot of stories there in these small registers and these annals. And so there's a monumental amount of work to be done. What we know about the social structure of the empire, I wouldn't say scratching at the surface, because that would be hyperbole, but certainly we don't have a complete picture. It just doesn't exist right now. And the only way I think that we can achieve a more holistic picture of the social structure is by looking at this group of people, these Ministeriales. And one person I would say that I found particularly interesting was a man named Heinrich von Lautern. And Heinrich von Lautern was a guy who was born to a Ministeriale. He was born probably in the same year as Emperor Henry VI, and they grew up together. And this Heinrich von Lautern was a Ministeriale, but he was trained to be a marshal. And so he became a knight, became a marshal of the imperial armies, and ended up becoming the chamberlain of the emperors. He became the best friend, essentially. And you see this because Heinrich von Lautern shows up in almost 150 charters within less than 10 years. And so within fewer than 10 years, this guy is showing up more often than most princes are. And he's basically there all the time, wherever the emperor is. And so there's a good 5-year span where you know where he is every 2 weeks. He's always being mentioned. He did everything from being a marshal to being a chamberlain to becoming an envoy of the emperor. He's likely one of the envoys who delivered the ransom money for Richard the Lionheart. So he's this major player who's completely been overlooked. There's not a single Wikipedia over him. There's nothing over him. And so he's one of these characters that I really found fascinating, because it's like, how can this guy be overlooked? And he's one of many examples of people of that caliber who's just been completely ignored. And so he's probably one of the more egregious examples of a historical character not getting the respect that's due. But after his emperor died, he went back home, essentially, and just went into hiding or something. He just basically fell off the map, and he doesn't show up in any charters anywhere, even the local ones, until the very end of his life, where he declares his testament and how he's giving his estate or what remains to him, to his nephew. So it's really this guy who achieves the highest level that he could possibly have attained at the right-hand side of the emperor. And then at the death of the emperor, just goes home. That's it. Duty's over. So he's a really, really fascinating character. Certainly know more about him within that short amount of period than probably anyone else. He shows up more than any other ministeriale ever. So he's a really fascinating character.
I am glad that we can give Heinrich his due today, at least.
Yeah.
What a wonderful note to end on. I have to say then, thank you so much, Aaron. This has truly been such a pleasure, such an interesting conversation. You've taught me a lot, and I hope everybody listening can say the same.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. We've talked about a lot of things here. Everything we've mentioned will be linked below at multiculturalmiddleages.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe, leave a review, and share it with others who might be interested in medieval history or any of the things we've talked about today. Until next time.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Lee, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.